KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
The Academy Award-winning director of An Inconvenient Truth and He Named Me Malala. Ladies and gentlemen, please, Mr. Davis Guggenheim. So, talk to me a little bit about growing up in that house with your father making those films. What was that like?
Well, for those, we mentioned it briefly, my father made documentary films, and one of my earliest memories was in 1968, my father waking me up and saying, "Do you want to go to work with me today?" And I said, "But it's dark outside." He goes, it was very early in the morning, and it was, he was filming with Bobby Kennedy, and I remember getting on this plane with these guys in suits and guys with cameras, and I said, "This is the coolest job I could ever imagine." And my father was this lovely man. He was a lovely man, and he was a great teacher, and he was a great father. And he felt very passionately about the movies that he makes, the movies he made, and that sort of came through. And the kitchen table conversation was about, you know, storytelling, and that if you're gonna be a storyteller, it better be for something good.
Well, that's something. That's why I mentioned the Little Rock film, because it's, in addition to being a piece about an issue, it's a really great piece of storytelling, and he gives us an emotional point of entry in all those films. In fact, that Bobby Kennedy show is a really beautiful piece of rabble rousing, and it really sort of gets you excited about the possibilities, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I would, you know, I was a sort of an angry college kid and post college kid, and I would talk about the films I wanted to make, and we'd sit around, and he would never tell me what to do, and he would never give me advice. He was very gentle. But I would talk about some issues, and he goes, "What's the story?" And he goes, "The issues are important. The issues were what we talked about on the round the table, but your movie better have a story." And it at the core of that, and story is so broadly understood by so many people in this room and by you and by me so differently. You know, we all project a different thing on that. But for him, it was, he always used to say, films are about people. And as much as you're making a film about this and this and this and this, films about people. And he had passed away before I made Inconvenient Truth. He had seen my first film about public school teachers. And the first documentary I made after he had passed away was about Inconvenient Truth. And I just remember, and it was fresh. His death was fresh. And that movie was about a slideshow, and it had a lot of charts and graphs and a lot of brain stuff. And I just kept remembering him saying, "What's the story? Who's this about?" And to me, that's the emotional core of that movie is a very personal man's redemption story. And so he, I think when that movie was over, I said, okay, my father is still, I got through his death and the pain of that after making that movie, feeling like, okay, he's still alive in me, my father. He's still teaching, he's still on my shoulder speaking to me, he's still teaching me.
Because one of the things that really, we can see it here in He Named Me Malala, you like these people who are characters, and she's really a character in addition to everything else, isn't she?
Oh, my God. the first time I met them, and I should say Walter Parks and Laurie MacDonald are here, and they produce this movie. I should say, in the spirit of this movie, thank you for the house lights. There they are. In the spirit of this movie, I should say Laurie MacDonald and Walter Parks. But Laurie's mother is here, so welcome, Miss MacDonald. they asked me to do this movie, and I said, let me read for a few days. And I said, it has to be more than this story about a girl who got shot. And very quickly, I went to their house 3 days later and said, this is a father-daughter story. I want to make a father-daughter story. And there are two other people tonight, Stella and Agnes, who are my daughters. And I want the movies I make to play on me. I don't want to be dispassionate. I want to be passionate. I want the movies to play on me. And maybe at that moment I was feeling not so good as a father, and not so good as a father of two daughters.
How do you mean?
I think as a parent, you don't know whether you're doing too much or too little. Simplify it. Am I trying to teach them too much and just shutting them down, or am I doing too little and backing off? And I feel confounded by this idea of what it means to be a father. And I think at that very moment, as I read the story, I was like, wait a minute, there's something between this man in Pakistan, 7,000 miles away, and this girl from Pakistan, 7,000 miles away, in this relationship that I have to figure out. And forget all the global politics for a moment. Let me figure out, why did this girl in this patriarchal society feel so confident and feel that she could speak out in such a clear voice? Where did she get that from? And how did he help her get there? I want to know. I want to, as I make this film, figure that out. And that was sort of like the sort of my way in. And then once I have the way in, then, you know, then I go.
As you say that, one of the things that sort of happens in all these films, and we even get that in that first film of yours, is people figuring out that they're kind of these crisis points, and people figuring out who they are. And it's very different here, because this is a young person who's still becoming what she's going to become, but she had this voice so early that it feels like it must have been kind of daunting in that way, because she's at this incredible power at such a young age.
Well, you know, and this is the early conversations with Laurie and Walter, is she's named after a girl, a legendary Pashtun girl who speaks out and is killed for speaking out. And she speaks out and is almost killed for speaking out. What does that say about who she's going to become? And does she have her own free will? And those things, you know. So I needed to know. I needed to try to figure these two people out. And as much as it's loaded with all this other stuff about the global South and this culture that was very new to me, at the core of it, I wanted to figure these two people out.
Because something you do, which I find so interesting, is you let the characters tell their stories. And all these films you've made, you find, and often certainly in Waiting for Superman here, it's a young person.
Yeah.
And you let these, so it's really interesting that you use these voices to tell these stories. And I wonder what made you decide to do that instead of using a narrator to tell us a story, by having it start with her, with the animation telling the story of that region.
Well, if you were to technically pull apart this movie, you'd say that this movie is narrated by Malala and her father. But it comes from this process I sort of stumbled on. In Inconvenient Truth, I was interviewing Al Gore a lot on camera, and the conversations were very formal. And then when we both decided to sit down and have these conversations without a camera, audio, they became more intimate. And so I took a cab to their house in Birmingham, England, and I rang their doorbell, and I said, and no crew. And they go, where's your crew? I'm like, we're just going to sit down and talk. And it was just me and Malala in her little office where the Post-its are. And we sat down for like 3 hours, just a microphone. And she goes, where are your notes? I said, I have no notes. Let's just talk. I want to. And what the bargain was with me and him, me and her, and then me and her father, was let me help you tell your own story. And it changes the nature. I think in documentaries, like, it's interesting. It's like someone's making a documentary about you. Suddenly, 10 people are coming into your house, and people are plugging things in, and they're turning on lights, and they're asking you to sit a certain way, and they're putting tape marks next to your chair, and they're saying, don't lean in because, you know, there's a reflection in your glasses. And suddenly you realize that there's this process which is taking over. And I think that's the thing that Al and I discovered when we made Inconvenient Truth, is that, like, we have to get past that. And so very quickly, when I sat down with Malala and her father that first day, they said, we've told you things we've never told anybody. And some of these things were the story of her mother selling her books for candy, or the myth, the Pashtun story of Malala, who she's named after. And through those conversations came a lovely, rich tone that I realized could only be done through animation. and I wanted to capture that tone, which was the opposite of sort of what I was used to seeing from that part of the world.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
But it's also, especially documentaries of the last 20 years or so, have the filmmaker in the middle of everything. And we see that presence sort of leading us through. And you've made this choice to break from that and to make these films that are much more intimate.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if that was something you arrived at through Inconvenient Truth. Was that something in the back of your mind that you kind of always wanted, that you figured had to be in these films to make them different?
I don't have a master plan. In Waiting for Superman, I narrate the movie, and it's basically an editorial. I feel like that movie's an editorial, and my opinion is in it. So that's very different from this movie, where I just feel like I'm a midwife, and I'm helping them give birth to their own story, and I'm pulling them out. And so the idea is, instead of me saying this is the myth of this girl, Mei Wan, the first animation that you see in the movie, it's like that's the story as a young girl would imagine it. So I'm trying to put myself in their shoes and trying to tell the story from their point of view.
But even in Waiting for Superman, you're still taking us in, letting them tell their own stories too. You're not telling us what to feel in that movie. You're basically setting a context more than really narrating it.
Well, who cares about me?
I mean, I don't know who does care about
you,
Davis.
I don't know. No, I mean, maybe my family. But the point that the point is that, you know, I'm interested in them.
Yeah.
I'm. She's so amazing. Her father is so amazing. And. Right? You know, and arriving at their house, I took a taxi cab to their house and ringing their doorbell. I was like, I'm walking into the home of a Muslim family. And I've met a few Muslim people. I've never really gotten to know a Muslim family. And here I am walking in, and who am I going to meet? And the people you saw is who I saw. It's like, I want to just do everything I can to pull them out and put them and give them to you. That's what I feel like my job is. And when I say who cares about me, it's more of like, you know, I'm not interested in that. You know, and I think, I mean, you look at Michael Moore or Errol Morris, and that's a very different point of view. And I like it, and I need it. I need that. But that's not what I'm going after. You know, it's a very different thing that I'm interested in something different.
Yeah, because I was just thinking about that. I was at the Democratic Convention in 2008.
Yeah.
And seeing that film, I almost felt like what it must have been like when your dad was making that Bobby Kennedy film. And it's, again, a really intimate piece that takes on this power as we get to know this person. And I feel like that was almost kind of this crucible, this foundry in which you were shaped, just sort of the power of a person telling their own story.
Right.
I mean, that was an amazing night.
That was an amazing night. That was 2008, Barack Obama's first Democratic convention, and it was exactly 40 years, almost to the day that my father made a film about Bobby Kennedy, and he had been assassinated only weeks earlier. And so that was very intense and meaningful. And the feeling that Barack Obama was sort of a continuation of Bobby Kennedy's story.
I mean, talk about what it felt like that I can't talk about, I almost get sort of teary-eyed, talking about what it felt like to be in that stadium with those people and just to feel the shift in the world. What was it like for you to shoot that and then see it play in front of these people who were waiting for this thing to happen?
It was Denver. It was August. August?
Yeah.
And the light had just come down from the sky, and there was about 70,000 people. And it was right before Barack Obama came out on stage. So it was the film that played right before he came out. The film ends, he walks out. There's no words can describe it. There's no, I mean, it was a magical night.
What did you want to do? I mean, because again, I just can't help but think about that previous film, the Bobby Kennedy film. It was just about this story being told by people who are waiting for, you know what I mean? Waiting for this moment, this epical moment of change.
Well, so the morning that my father woke me up to take me on the plane with Bobby Kennedy, I remember that very clearly. And then I remember months later, I was 5 years old, so I was sleeping in between my mother and my father, and the phone ringing. And we were in Washington, D.C., so it's 3 hours later. And I remember my father going to the phone and collapsing to his knees and breaking down into tears. And that was him hearing that Bobby Kennedy had been killed. And my father was doing the media for his campaign. And so suddenly his job shifted from doing the media for his campaign to making a memorial to this man for the convention that would be months later. And that in that convention, which was as well documented, was chaos and riots and anger. And they played that film in the convention hall in Chicago, and there was nonstop singing for an hour. And it was this culmination of this, the life of this one man. And so I can't describe what it was like in Denver, but to feel like Bobby Kennedy was alive again in this new candidate who had all this hope was pretty special.
Yeah, I mean, I just, these emotional journeys that these films are about, and there's so often these journeys of discovery. I mean, we still get that here. I mean, somebody who's still discovering herself. But even in Waiting for Superman, it's about, finally, these films, in their way, they're all about hope, aren't they? I mean, each of these documentaries you've done.
I don't know how to make movies about people I hate. I mean, no, and those movies need to be made. No, they do. They need to be made. And I feel like there's in my mind, there's a battle between a very cynical side in me. I can be dark and cynical as a person. I can read the paper very clinically and move past things. And then there are moments when my heart opens up. And there's a battle with me between that. And yes, my wife, Lisa, is here. You know, I can get dark and cynical, and then I don't want to be that person. And I want my work, because I've also, you know, I've done some dark work, especially when I was younger. And I go home feeling more dark. And so when I do the opposite, when I tell a story that opens my heart, this story opened my heart. You know, getting to know this Pashtun family opened my heart. And if that happens, I'm a happier guy. I don't know.
makes sense, because
that's a sort of therapy. I didn't realize this is I owe you $100 for an hour, or
yes, you do. Yes, you do.
But I didn't realize this was gonna.
I didn't either. Now I'm really scared. But let's move on, shall we?
Okay.
Because I think what happens so often in these films is there is this moment of sort of like happiness, of sort of peace.
Yeah.
Just thinking about what becomes a kind of a generational conflict, and it might get loud.
Yeah.
And not only generational, but also basically sort of these different countries, really. I mean,
yeah.
It really is like these three things coming together, but there's this moment of happiness, and they kind of all realize that they're working towards the same thing.
Yeah.
And just seeing her in that house, we see this kind of, we see who she really is.
Yeah.
And I just think about being in those houses with people, being in those houses and waiting for Superman and getting to see what people are like when they're away from everybody else. Those are the moments in the movies I love when they become really intimate about who these people are.
Yeah.
And it's got to be about you winning their trust.
Yes. Yeah, and I didn't know whether they would what they would think of me. I mean, the third night of filming, Ziadine, Malala's father, grabbed my hair. It said, "What would he do with your hair?" You know, he would say, he said, "Is may I touch it?" I'm like, "Yeah." "Is it real?" I'm like, "Yes, it's real." They literally thought I was this alien from Los Angeles. But then they were lovely, and interestingly, I think because of reality television, because of selfies and Facebook and everything like that, I find shooting in America, in the West, people are so in control of their own narrative. They're putting their story on Facebook. They are already sort of like writing their narrative or their press release. And so when you go in to tell their story, they're already editing for you their narrative. And so you're kind of battling, or not battling, but kind of wrestling with the baggage that they bring to the conversation. And this family was the opposite. They were completely an open book. And, you know, Malala saying she hits her younger brother, and the older brother saying, "I'm mom's favorite." And it was so refreshing to meet a family that just totally let me in. And even though I'm this oddball, after a couple of days, they're like, "Come on, you're a part of the family." And that felt really good.
But what's it like then when you deal with people like Barack Obama or The Edge or Al Gore, who got by the time they get to you, they have created these narratives, and half the questions you ask they've been asked a bunch of times before. What is that like to do those kinds of projects?
Well, you're telling a story about someone people think that they know. And, you know, I feel like I'm battling with the first page of the Wikipedia article. You know, the girl who got shot and won the Nobel Peace Prize, and then you read that and you move on. And so part of it is doing these very intimate interviews without the camera is being there a lot, pushing them really hard, asking really tough, candid questions, and pushing them to open up. So there's like layers of this baggage that you sort of have to get through, and there's no secret to do it other than knowing that you have to do it and find a way.
But also, some of these people you've made films about have an enormous amount of self-awareness.
Yeah.
So the idea of getting them past that,
yeah,
because they're presentational. I mean, they're,
yeah,
to some extent, used to sort of selling a story about themselves.
Yeah.
And that must take even more time to sort of break through that.
Yeah, it does. And sometimes it's why I put my question in the movie. You know, I say to Malala, you know, "You don't like to talk about your suffering." And she sort of doesn't answer the question. And I say, "You're not answering the question." And part of it is her non-answer is an answer. Her avoiding is also the answer, and so that's me trying to just drill in.
And also, you have to include the silence too, because she's earned that. I mean,
yeah,
if it's just her talking all the time, that's not,
yeah,
an honest representation of who she is.
That's right.
I mean, and that's what I mean by that intimacy. You get us to that point where we can see that she's not this machine, because when we see her in talk show appearances or things, she's so preternaturally composed,
yeah,
and so well spoken. And so quick with a line,
yeah,
to see her pause,
yeah,
is a really telling moment.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And you're agreeing with me. I guess you saw your movie. Good for you. Good for you. I'm glad you saw your film.
Sorry.
But no, I didn't mean to talk to you about your film. We'll talk about something else. But the idea of including that, I thought, was a really brave moment. Because I thought, and that happens in so many of the movies. I mean, we see The Edge in Mike Get Loud, we see him unsure. And this is a guy, you see him on stage, he knows how to make every piece of equipment work for him. And to see him seem to be lost a little bit, just sort of in this way, I don't want to say taking us backstage, but taking us past what we know about these people, is the thing that really excites you about doing these movies, isn't it?
I think people want to present a certain person. We all do. And then also people want to confess. That it, deep down inside, you know, if you and I spent enough time to each other, you'd see a side of me you wouldn't see after the first night. But people want to be understood, and that means not just the Wikipedia page, but you want to my frailties, my fears. And so that's what makes people human. And I say that as if it's some big statement. It's not, but that's the challenge. Is, and it's even more hard when you have a film crew there to get that to come out. So that's what you're working against.
Because I guess you just showed the film this afternoon to a group of young women here.
Yeah.
Talk about that experience a little bit before we finish up.
Well, today was a tale of two screenings. Here we are at LACMA, at this great museum, with this, you know, the New York Times and this great institution and very thoughtful crowd.
Well, some of them are, not many, but anyway.
And Film Independent. And this morning at downtown at the Microsoft Center, I think it's called, we screened the movie for 6,000 high school girls. Yeah. And these are girls who are in schools with 75% free and reduced lunch, which means, you know, poor neighborhoods. And I had no idea what this crowd would think. I mean, it was 6,000 people. And you could hear a pin drop when Malala gets shot at the end of the movie. And you could hear the roar, you know, when she says, you know, when she speaks at the UN. And to me, that's what it's all about, is I think for many girls, this will be their first documentary they'll ever see. And they'll see a girl who, an ordinary girl who makes a choice to speak out for what she believes. And how cool is it that those 6,000 girls saw that? How cool is it that my daughters tonight see that? And that, to me, that's the reason why I do this.
Well, anything you can do to keep... Thank you. Yeah, please.
Thank you.
Anything you can do to keep young girls from watching Keeping Up with the Kardashians is okay with me. Let's thank Davis Guggenheim for being here tonight.
Thank you, Elvis. The great Elvis Mitchell.
Catch up on past episodes with the treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.